We're glad to see everyone tonight. We're glad that you're back here for our study tonight. And I think that several have already expressed that their plan tonight is to block out, like wives, you're going to block that part out and you're going to hear the part about husbands. And husbands are going to block out the part about husbands and hear the part about wives. But of course, that is not the plan. And so I do want you to listen carefully and thoughtfully to the lesson tonight. Husbands and wives. This relationship is the first human relationship that God provided for. Had you ever thought about it like that? Now, of course, there was the relationship between Adam and God. But this is the first human relationship that God provided for. And all other relationships among human beings grow out of this one. All other family relationships, at least. All other family relationships grow out of this one. And as you know, the husband-wife relationship was planned by God and was begun in the Garden of Eden. Now, with those things said, there are a number of points that I want to make for all of us to think very, very carefully about tonight. There are many factors that make it really, really important for us to examine the Bible teaching on this relationship from time to time. In a way, it can hardly be looked at too much. If you look at the trouble that marriage is having today, I know that since I have been here just in the years I've been at Eastside, I would not be able to tell you how many families or husband-wife relationships that I have been called to have a part in working with. And I have been involved in working with some that I doubt if anybody else knows about other than the people themselves. But it's amazing. This means that there is a lot of trouble that occurs today between couples. And we need to look at this, what the Bible says about this, because of that. We need to know what the Bible teaches about how a husband and a wife must discharge their role. We also really need to study this subject in order to counter the influences of a society that discounts the sanctity of marriage. And you might as well face it. We're living in some ways a worse than pagan society. We're living in a society where the ones that set the worst examples are the leaders of our society. The leaders of our society and the ones that our society looks up to are the ones that set the worst example. It is a very sad thing that so much of our society looks at movie stars and rock stars and such people as that as their examples. And if you ever read about some interview with one of them, you can almost count on it that they're going to say something like, "Well, I think it's important that we have a relationship, but I never have thought very much about locking yourself in with this other person and saying there's no other love in my life that I can ever." And what they're just saying is they'd rather fornicate. That's what they're saying. And yet we look up to them and admire them. And they are having a terribly destructive effect upon our society. And we look at our leaders, whether it's government or industry, and we are living in a society that discounts the sanctity of marriage. And we also need to study these things in order to see that marriage is not, absolutely not, definitely not, in no way is it a union between two men or two women. There is simply no way that can be true. I want to refer to these passages just briefly, and there are many others that we could look at. But these are two that are very clear. In Leviticus 18, God expresses His view about such things as this. In verse 22, "Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination." Abomination. Not just sin, abomination. Verse 23, "And thou shalt not lie with any beast to defile thyself therewith. Neither shall any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereto. It is confusion." Homosexual relationship is an abomination. And so when he says here, "Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind," it is abomination. It is talking about an illicit sexual relationship. This is homosexuality. It is an abomination. The sin referred to in verse 23 is called bestiality. And it is based on the meaning of beast, B-E-A-S-T, bestiality. And what it means is for a human being to have a sexual relationship with an animal. And we're living in a world in which there are some nations. While I was in Europe, I heard of one of the European countries that is beginning to have trouble with bestiality. Well, once all restraints are cast off, once there is no respect or reverence for God's word, then what is beyond the reach of a human being to do? And so this is a condemnation of a sexual relationship that simply must not prevail. And so in Leviticus 18, 22 and 23, we find that. And also in chapter 20 and verse 13. "And if a man lie with mankind as with womankind, both of them have committed abomination, they shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them." Therefore, this is considered a most serious sin. So these are some of the factors that make it very important for us to study what the Bible says on this subject. Marriage must involve the whole person. Talking here about an individual with body and soul and mind, marriage must involve the whole person. So as I talk about this now, what I want you to do, please, is to take these ideas and think about them in your own case, making application to your own life. Let each one of us be sure that we do that. There is so much superficiality and vanity about us today. I go walking about. I go in the mall, not very often, but I go in the mall once in a while. When I go in the mall, I observe, and I see there so much superficiality. And there was an interesting comment made to me by Tatiana Morrow, Mike Morrow's wife. They live in Prague. And she was talking about the differences that have come to be in the last few years. And one of the things that they now have is Prague has some really great malls. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, wow, to have a mall. Okay, so what do you do? Well, she pointed out that she said a lot of the girls do nothing but walk up and down the mall buying whatever little thing they can and wishing they could afford more. Superficiality. And that's what Tatiana was bemoaning. That the society has become more materialistic, and as it has become more materialistic, it has become more superficial. And what I'd like you to understand is that the more materialistic you become in your outlook, the more superficial you're going to be. It cannot be otherwise. So many people know only selfishness. What do I like? What do I want? What am I going to do? Who is noticing me is selfishness. And the things that are important to us are often the most temporal and foolish things imaginable. And so often there is no understanding, no fundamental understanding of what marriage is and what it involves. Marriage must involve the whole person, body and mind and soul. Now, how about this for a heading for everyone to think about? There have never been two perfect people who got married. Never been two perfect people who got married. So you know what this means? Adjustments. That's what it's going to take. Adjustments. That means that if I expect my wife to adjust, then I need to be thinking about, well, maybe there are some adjustments I'm going to need to make too. There aren't any two people who are going to get married who are not going to have adjustments to make. And there must be the recognition of the necessity of those adjustments, and there must be the willingness for those adjustments to take place. Absolutely, they must. And sometimes I think that marriage is entered into with all the seriousness of buying a used car. It's a lark. Going to go out and thump a few cars around, kick a few tires, drive and have a good time and get one. We don't like it, we'll get another one. Now you may do that with cars, but you will not do that with marriage. And get away. You will not. This is the most serious thing, and I want you to understand it is the most serious thing. There are adjustments that must be made. Now, often people get married because they are in lust when they should be in love. Now, this is not at all to try to deny that physical desire, sexual desire plays its part. I'm not at all trying to deny that. But often the thing that drives the whole attraction and the whole relationship is lust. Okay, so we say it's sanctioned because we're getting married, okay? But you're going to have a time making that marriage work if that's all that has pulled the couple together. If the mere physical desire is all that's been there thus far, it will not be enough to hold the couple together. One of the differences between lust and love is that lust will not motivate people to do what is necessary to make a marriage work, but love will. That's a big difference. That's just one of the differences. But in connection with the study that we're making and the points that we're making tonight, this is a very important distinction. Lust will not motivate people to do what is necessary to make a marriage work. But love will. So I want to make you think about that, and all of us need to think about that, and make sure that we understand what the foundation of our marriage is, and make sure that foundation is what it ought to be. Now, these adjustments that I'm talking about are the things that must be adapted to make a marriage work. I'm going to illustrate with some of them. Temperament. Rarely are two people perfectly matched in temperament. You may have a couple where one is hot-tempered and the other is easygoing. Now let's play around with that. You might say, well, now that looks like a real good match there because one's hot-tempered and the other's easygoing. Well, it may be a good match, but how will it work? It will so often work by the one who is easygoing lying down and becoming a doormat to accommodate the temper of the other one. Now, does that sound like it's working? It is not working. And that doesn't always happen. Sometimes you've got the hot-tempered one and the easygoing one that they do make some adjustments and they work things out so that the temper comes under control somewhat, and the easygoing one develops the ability to sometimes speak her mind or speak his mind or whatever, and they work out a good relationship. But very often what happens in this is the one that is hot-tempered becomes the bully and is going to push the other one around and demand, or I'm going to get mad, and the other one gives in. So one demands and one gives in, and one demands and one gives in, and that's the way it goes. And it goes that way until one day, boom. That can't be. One of the adjustments that must be made if you find yourself in a relationship like this, if you're the hot-tempered one, you're going to have to realize this is too destructive. I cannot allow this. I can't even be a Christian and be this way. I must bring my temper under control. And there is no excuse that I can use. None. Absolutely none. Forget them. There isn't one. It has to be brought under control. That adjustment must be made. And let me tell you something else. When a couple gets married, if they do love each other, and if they do want in that faraway day, hopefully it'll be a faraway day when both of them die, they will want the other one to go to heaven. Surely that would be the case if you loved each other. And if you're thinking in those terms, then the hot-tempered one should be able and should be willing and strong enough to look into his heart or her heart and say, I am going to be the ruin of my marriage, and I'm also going to be the ruin of my partner. What I need to do is settle myself down, bring myself under control, and I need to help my partner develop. To help my partner develop. Oh, there's such a big difference. Because there's another element that enters into this, and it is the element of complete selfishness and self-absorption. Sometimes we are so selfish and so self-absorbed that ourselves are all we think about, and we don't even think about, how am I helping my partner to grow? How am I helping my partner to develop? And if we love that partner, not only will we not take advantage of a frailty or a weakness, but we will want to help that partner grow strength instead of frailty. Instead of weakness. And then you'll have a control person versus the passive. A lot of the same problems come here. You can have all sorts of weird mixtures. Now, like a control person is a person who, no matter what, must be in control. And sometimes this becomes a compulsion to the extent that a person who has this problem will do absolutely anything to exert the control. It may be to use anger. It may be to feign illness. Anything that works becomes fair to use, to gain control. Everything, every decision, everything. And one person is continually put down, and the other one takes in more and more and more control. Now here, just like in the hot temper, you have got to learn to recognize yourself And you've got to learn to recognize if you are a person who craves control. And if you are a person like that, you're going to have to look at yourself spiritually. And you're going to have to look at your partner spiritually. And you're going to have to say, what is going to happen to me if I don't bring this tendency under control? And what is going to happen to my partner if I don't bring this tendency under control? You will destroy your marriage, and you will destroy yourself, and you may very well destroy your partner also. That's the reason why I'm emphasizing these adjustments. They're necessary. They have to be made. Or you may have one person who is orderly, calm, organized. I'm trying to think of someone like that. But there are calm, orderly, organized. Others are flaky, emotional, haphazard, and they get married. Yes, adjustments. Adjustments. The orderly, calm, organized person may let that become an absolute compulsion. And then that compulsion takes control of the person and the home and the family and everything they touch. I'm going to have to realize that when someone is not as orderly as I would like them to be, that doesn't mean that they're bad or wicked. It doesn't even mean that they don't get much done. They may get a good bit done. So they're not evil. If you can be calm, I'm going to encourage you and say, I wish I could always do that. I'm not even going to try to talk you out of not being calm. I think that if you've got that one, then I'm going to just say, well, good for you. I don't think I would advise you to try to become uncalm. But what you might do is work hard to help your partner learn how to be calm. Sometimes someone has said, if you can be calm when everything is going to pieces all around you, that means you don't know what's going on. And maybe that's the case. Orderly, calm, organized. You know what? In anything like this, in a marriage, you need to know the other one well. And you need to know, is this what I am going to be able to live with? Is this what I'm going to be able to be happy with? And is my partner going to be able to be happy with this? And then adjustments are going to have to be made. And that person that is flaky, emotional, haphazard is going to have to work hard to try to make sure that those qualities do not make him or her undependable. Now then, you've got a situation here where someone may find it real hard to stay in touch with what's going on. They may find it sort of difficult to know, to see needs around them. A lot of people have trouble. A lot of people have trouble seeing the needs that are around them. You've got to control that. You've got to control that. You must learn to be aware. You must learn to be dependable. Because if you let your personality get you to the point you're not dependable, then you're into sin. You're into sin. Now, personality can be one of those things that, okay, you do this or you do that, and it's not sin. But personality can sometimes do things that will get you into stuff that is sin. And when that happens, then you've got to get it under control, or it's going to affect your soul. And so this is not just about making marriages work. This is also about your soul. It's also about going to heaven. What must be avoided at all costs in a marriage is turf wars. We go in the thing, and instead of being together, this is mine. and don't you step on it. Well, this is mine, and don't you step on it. And get our bricks and our mortar, and we start building our wall up here. And occasionally throw a brick at the other one. Turf wars. And so often it happens right away. It happens right away if we're not very careful. Well, I know what I want, and I intend to get what I want. Oh, I didn't say that. I just thought it. But that's what we do. I'm going to get my way however I have to do it. We don't put that into words, but that's what's involved in a turf war. And what so often happens is that all weapons are then brought into play. And what happens is not very pretty, because ego gets involved. Ego is a problem. Ego is a real problem. And any time ego gets involved in a relationship, then the relationship is in trouble. You perceive that you are not being esteemed as you should. And the other partner says, well, I'm not either. And so, can you see us drawing the lines? Can you see us building our wall there? Responsibilities that are undertaken when you agree to get married, those responsibilities are completely forgotten. You know, isn't it so wonderful? And you're standing there, yes, I do, yes, I will, yes, I do, yes, I will. And then, what? We forget about all of them. What did you say you would do? Oh, I will do this until death us do part. Do what? Till how long? You know, sometimes we make that all one big word, death us do part. But that's actually a sentence. Death us do part. That means that I have formed a relationship with you, my wife, or the wife with her husband, that I am going to do all I can to make it last until death. And we make some pretty heavy promises when we're getting married. But it may be like one of my relatives who was getting married, and she was objecting to the language, which was scriptural language. She was objecting to the language, and she was about to back out. She was about to kick the whole idea. And her helpful father-in-law came to her. He was the hero of the moment because he settled her nerves by telling her, those are just words, and you don't have to do them anyhow. Those are just words. You don't have to do them anyhow. Now, even though we don't usually hear it put like that, a lot of times in a marriage, that's what it sounds like. That's what it looks like. They were just words. We don't have to actually do those things. We'll have a situation where, in order to get his way, the man sulls up, won't talk to his wife. About as much fun to have around as a lamp. Or he's going to show her by going out and spending a whole lot of money on a new gun. Or he'll leave her and he'll go hunting with his buddies for a week. Leave her. Got to show her. You know what? On my word processor, when I wrote Saul's, my word processor did not like that word, as if it were not a word. Who ever heard of such a thing? Of course that's a word. And we all know what it means, don't we? Have you ever sold up? Someone says, I don't think I ever have. If there is anyone who never has, I'd like to get to know you better. Because I think the time comes when nearly every one of us does that. But in a marriage, it is not a tool to use. And the wife may do exactly the same things except go hunting with her buddies for a week. Now, generally, she won't use that technique. But there may be other things she will go and do with her buddies for a week. Just show old stubborn. Well, you see, what I'm talking about here is in that kind of behavior, we have established our turf. I've got my little fort over here and you've got your little fort over there. And all we're doing is shelling each other. We're just shelling each other. And if we keep shelling each other, we're going to destroy each other. A husband is to love his wife and be a companion to her, period. That's it. Preacher, tell me what I'm supposed to do to be a good husband. Husbands, love your wives, period. If you do that, you will have done what you're supposed to do. But that entails a lot. And turning to that passage in Ephesians chapter 5, listen to the words that Paul uses. Husbands, love your wives. Even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for it. Look in verses 28 and 29. Even so ought husbands also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his own wife loveth himself, for no man ever hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as Christ also the church. So every time a man thinks about his wife and how he should regard his wife, what a beautiful example he has to look at. How did Christ treat the church? Husbands, love your wives even as Christ also loved the church. The wife is to love her husband because the older women were supposed to teach the younger women to love their husbands. This is true of the husband. This is true of the wife. Each one is to love the other. Love in the sense, in the greater sense. I don't know. It would take a long time. We'd have to have just a separate lesson to elaborate on the meaning of this kind of love. But it's set forth right there in Ephesians 5. As Christ also loved the church, gave himself up for it. So Christ loved the church. It was his great concern. It was his consuming concern that he loved the church. And so it is with a wife. She is to love her husband. And sometimes a husband or a wife may use sexual privileges or the withholding thereof to get their way. I have known of both and have dealt with both. It doesn't work. That's the first thing to know. It doesn't work. And what it will do is stir up bitterness and resentment. The sexual relationship is not N-O-T, anything we don't understand about not. It is not to be used as a weapon of warfare or as a tool of manipulation. I'm reading from 1 Corinthians chapter 7. verses 1 through 5. And these words are so clear that nothing else needs to be spoken, but they are to be regarded. They are to be respected. Now concerning the things whereof ye wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, meaning sexually. And I must say that in the context of 1 Corinthians 7, there were particular circumstances that made relationships at this time something to avoid if you were not already in one, because of the difficulty of the times. And so that's what he means in that verse. Verse 2, but because of fornications, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. The point is to avoid fornication. God has provided for the satisfying of sexual desire. There is a way to do it as the world does it, and then there is a way to do it, as Paul writes to the Thessalonians, in sanctification. 1 Thessalonians 4. In sanctification means as God has provided. So the point is to avoid fornication. Verse 3. Let the husband render unto the wife her due, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. Do you see that that is a mutual relationship? Do you see that? That is a mutual responsibility. Verse 4, the wife hath not power over her own body, but the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power over his own body, but the wife. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be by consent for a season, that you may give yourselves unto prayer and may be together again, that Satan tempt you not because of your incontinency. So the point here is that sexual activity is engaged in on the part of that partner who has the desire, not on the part of the partner who doesn't have it. Because it is the desire that, if not satisfied, could lead one to commit fornication. So the sexual relationship is not to be used as a weapon of warfare or as a tool of manipulation. Now here's something else that we must take careful note of. Marriage involves divinely appointed roles. Marriage involves divinely appointed roles. The first one that we list here is that the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church. Now that's in the same passage where the relationship between Christ and the church is also used to demonstrate what our love for our wives should be. So we should love our wives as Christ also loved the church, but the husband is to be the head of his wife as Christ was head of the church. This means that in God's plan, when a woman marries a man, she does so with the intent of submitting to his leadership. That's what the words mean. That's what the teaching is. And so any girl, any young lady who thinks about marriage, and even when you're too young to be married, you need to be thinking about these things. That when you get married, there's a whole lot involved in it. And when you get married, you are doing so with the intent of submitting to the leadership of your husband. That is what God has ordained. Now it may be that someone says, well, I certainly have no intent and I'm going to get married, and so there. Well, I realize you can do that. I realize you can do that. I know that. But I am here to tell you that the day will come when you will rue the day that you said those words. And I don't want that day to come to you. I really don't. God has no pleasure in the death of the wicked, I have no pleasure in my prophecies coming true. And throughout the years, I have been remarkably accurate when I have uttered prophecies regarding marriages. I love to be wrong. But if you do not have the intent of submitting to your husband's leadership, then you don't have any business getting married, because you are going to be ignoring God's teaching on that subject. This also means that in God's plan, when a woman marries a man, she does so with the intent of showing him respect as the leader. It's not a respect that he has, because he was born a male, that he just automatically deserved. No, it has nothing to do with that. Nothing. What it has to do with is the appointment of God. That's it. It is the appointment of God. It is not of me. It is not of you. It is not of the world. It is of God. And this is what God says. This is what He says in His Word. I'm turning over here to 1 Peter 3. In like manner, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that even if any obey not the word, they may without the word be gained by the behavior of their wives, beholding your chaste behavior coupled with fear, whose adorning, let it not be the outward adorning of braiding the hair and of wearing jewels of gold or of putting on apparel. All of that simply meaning that's not to be the emphasis. But let it be the hidden man of the heart, in the incorruptible apparel of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. For after this manner aforetime the holy women also, who hoped in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose children ye now are, if you do well, and are not put in fear by any terror. We're not talking about a dictatorship here. We're not talking about a tyrant of a husband. We're not talking about a woman being a slave. We're talking about one who has been given the role of God to lead. And we've got the woman who becomes his partner and accepts his leadership. Now I'm talking at the moment about the wife. And I've made the point that in God's plan, when she marries a man, she must marry him with the intent of submitting unto him. When she marries a man, she must do so with the intent of showing him respect as the leader, not worshiping him, but acknowledging that he is the one that God has made the head. And the woman who does not do these things will give answer to the God who is a consuming fire. I put it this way because that's how serious it is. The husband is to love his wife. This means that in God's plan, when a man marries a woman, he does so with the intent of nourishing and cherishing her as Jesus did the church. This means that in God's plan, when a man marries a woman, he does so with the intent that he will not be harsh in his leadership. You see, God didn't forget a thing. In Colossians, listen to the point made here. Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them. The word bitter here means harsh. God knew that in the nature of things, when one is the leader and the other or the others are the followers, one who is a leader may be tempted to take advantage of his authority and to take advantage of his position. And he may be brusque and harsh. And God says that when a man marries a woman, he does so with the intent that he will not be harsh in his leadership. When you are harsh in your leadership, your wife can get to be afraid of you. Your children can get to be afraid of you. And it is a sad thing when the wife is afraid of her husband. It is a sad thing when the children get afraid. Okay, just ignore that. Concentrate. It is a sad thing when the children are afraid of their father. Let us husbands and fathers make sure that that is not the case. And if the husband is harsh and dictatorial and selfish, he will answer to the God who is a consuming fire. Marriage takes two. Marriage takes two. The best man in the world cannot be a good husband if his wife will not let him do the things that a good husband is to do. And the best woman in the world cannot be a good wife if her husband will not let her do the things that a woman is supposed to do. There is a work that each has to do, and a balance must be kept.